simplifying the language, new conceptual language for IR. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Okay, so our paper really represents an investigation into the relationships between complexity and international relations theory. And we kind of started from looking at early work in complexity in the 1990s, people like Rosenau, Jarvis, Sederman, and an edited collection by Harrison. And our feeling was really that there'd been no kind of cumulative research program or momentum arising from these particular studies of complexity in international politics. That the research agenda had become quite fragmented. Some people were using complexity purely in kind of metaphorical terms. Others were using it as a methodology. And it's certainly true that simulation became established as a methodology, and that was one benefit of this early work. But as we may make clear later on, we find this somewhat problematic. We also noted that at the same time, there were many people using, in different debates within international politics, language that was both very similar to the language used in complexity, but often without a kind of recognition of complexity. So it was always implicit within the work. So we picked out debates about relationalism, processual ontology, networks, new systems thinking, that bared a conceptual relevance to a resonance with complexity, but wasn't particularly picked up or made explicit. And what we also wanted to investigate was complexity as a social ontology, which was something that didn't often get picked up in these debates. And ontology has been very much on the agenda of international politics in recent years. So that's something that we'll talk about today as well. So we wanted to investigate complexity as a social ontology, but we also wanted to draw out the different linkages with relevant bodies of theory in international politics. And in the paper, we concentrate on three particular debates. The first one is processional and relational ontologies. The second is about the nature of the international system. And the third is about the nature of networks. So we'll talk about those three things, and then we'll try and draw out some of the kind of philosophical implications of the paper.
And one of the things we wanted to do is to take complexity seriously as an ontology. What kind of ontology can we derive from complexity? What does it say about the world, and what does that imply about what we can say or the ways we can act in the world? One first relationship we see between complexity and other developments within international relations and more broadly social thought is a move towards, or away from rather, essentialist conceptions of physical and social objects towards relational and processual ontologies. And that means an emphasis on relationships rather than on clearly defined entities or agents. Or as Fridtjof Capra put it, ultimately what we call a part is merely a pattern in an inseparable web of relationships. For the systems thinker, the relationships are primary. And this we want to argue quite forcefully, is that what we should be looking at are relationships rather than postulating fixed actors or agents. Indeed, we think that complexity can refocus attention on processes and social relations and offer a very different social ontology to those who see that, to those that see social entities, such as states, for example, as having pre-theoretical characteristics or dispositional interests, and something that structural realism or liberal institutionalism have been much critiqued for. There's notably much overlap with what's one of the developments in the field quite recently, what's been called the relational term. And relationism has attempted to develop an ontology that rejects essential notions of social units and sees social transactions and processes as the fundamental constituents of social reality. So in other words, if we are going to look at particular social entities, or agents or sites, we have to view them as historically situated and as potentially transient bundles of social processes. People like Patrick Jackson and Daniel Nexon have developed this view notably. And they've argued particularly that social relations come before states. And this problematizes, therefore, the theories that take the modern state system as a starting point and states as ontologically primitive units. I mean, one of the problems with realism, for example, is that it can't really explain the emergence of the state system. It takes states as a given, as the preeminent original actors that it describes in its theories. And relationism problematized this and allows us to develop accounts, processual accounts of how states emerge in the first place. Effectively, it means a transition between a conception of being to one of becoming, that privileges dynamic flux over stable essences, the idea that certain entities are given transhistorical and consistent characteristics. Methodologically, one of the ways in which that's been cashed out is in a search for, a shift away from search for general covering laws in favor of looking for specific mechanisms or processes. And this is something that Charles Tilly particularly has done in the field of historical sociology. And Tilly's argued that covering laws, necessary sufficient conditions, and generally systems accounts have resisted history as they tend to deny the particular times and places. So attempts to look for causes A, B, and C which cause event X of the covering law nature. Tillian has argued in favor of mechanism process accounts, which looks at mechanisms of quite a general scope, transactions and interactions, exchanges. And by looking at the initial conditions, the sequences, the combinations, the concatenations of mechanisms, we can explain variable overall outcomes. So we never have a single instance of revolution that's reproduced every time we have a revolution. We have unique instances of phenomena that resemble revolutions but are unique concatenations of particular processes. One of the benefits, we would argue, is that it avoids the twin pitfalls of methodological or phenomenological individualism on one hand and holistic and structuralist accounts on the other. In other words, we don't develop theories where we start from the assumption that there are predefined actors, as methodological individualism tended to do. And I think it's some of the limitations we see with modeling accounts, which tend to want to model the agents and don't really offer an account of how these agents are formed in the first place or how they may come to change. But also avoiding structuralist accounts that reduce the agents or the end parts to purely determinations of the system or the structure. The agents still have something in excess of what the system might, the forms that systems might give them. I think that's you now.
So the second debate that we then go on to look at is the debates about the nature of the international system. And clearly a lot of this kind of processual relational ontology has great relevance for this, because debates about the nature of the system really are about what should be the correct objects of analysis. Traditionally, people have focused on states. How do we conceptualize agents such as states and structures? How do we select them in the first place? And should we indeed see states as primary, as Antoine has kind of problematized? Is this a pre-theoretical move, and is it justifiable? And many of the usages of complexity within IR tend to fall into this trap, I would argue, is that they import states as pre-theoretical objects into their theories or models to begin with. So one of the things that we do is we say, what can complexity add to these debates about the international system? Well, firstly, we might say that sort of realist theories that Robert referred to in his presentation earlier were also built upon a general systems framework. So in a way, complexity can extend the taxonomy of the international system. And it does this with its kind of novel battery of concepts, such as openness, open systems, emergence, non-linearity. The second point is that a focus on complexity brings back history into systemic theorizing, which has tended to be quite ahistorical within international relations. So we look at system evolution and path dependency as important concepts. Secondly, the agent structure debate, which has also been important within IR, complexity leads us to focus on the meso level between the micro and the macro level and look at praxis as a kind of way of uniting those two, or practice as a way of uniting those two levels. And the other aspect that we also want to stress is this notion again of social ontology. And within here, there's two kind of interesting approaches that have come out of the literature recently. One of them based around complex adaptive systems, and the second, what's come to be known as assemblage theory, particularly in the work of Manuel de Landa. And assemblage theory is an attempt to move beyond essences and totalities, but at the same time not to reduce agents to individual persons. So, for example, de Landa's version of assemblage theory, and there are different versions, draws on the concept of emergence in order to show how a variety of social entities may be characterized as concrete individuals operating at different socio-spatial scales. So what the ontology that he develops is what he calls a flat ontology, and this means it's flat in the sense that each concrete individual that is assembled has the same ontological status, i.e. they are an individual, regardless of its spatial size and scale. So in this way, Delander starts at the subpersonal scale and moves up through nested systems, through individual persons, groups, networks, organisations, governments, cities and states, viewing all of these as emergent individuals comprised of, but not reducible to, populations of individuals existing at lower levels of social complexity. So the component parts of an emergent whole, or social assemblage, retain a level of autonomy and might, in the right historical circumstances, be detached and plugged into a different assemblage. So in a way, this is a way to retain the idea of systemic theorizing, but get away from all these ideas of totalizing systems that were the critique of the post-structuralist movement in the past. So one of the things we might think about, and this Saskia Sassen has done this in her work, is explore how the relation state, how its different elements in the contemporary period are being disassembled and reassembled into new formations at different scales, and different global social assemblages are emerging. So a primary attraction of this approach is its ability to move beyond forms of social theory that rely on essences or totalities, while at the same time providing a means to transcend reduction of the social to individual persons. The second approach that I highlighted was the complex adaptive systems approach, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, but I just want to highlight one recent innovation here by Kim Holloman, who argues that complex adaptive systems can be wedded to social constructivist approaches in international relations. So what she's really arguing here is that we can account for the evolution and internalization of ideational norms by actors in world politics, different actors in world politics, through a complex adaptive systems theoretical approach. So she argues that competition over rules be placed at the center of such approach to the international system, as successful rules are internalized by agents and become effective through self-regulation. So she's arguing essentially that world politics can be viewed as a complex adaptive system where non-linear dynamic interactions between agents at different scales, individuals, states, firms, international governmental organizations, produce continually evolving changes in both agents and structures. And I think really these two approaches move us quite a long way away from, you know, the idea of kind of pre-theoretical attachment to the state, and help to problematize that position.
When we look at one of the remarkable things in theoretical debates or in social sciences recently in the last 10, 20 years is the emergence of a particular concept that everyone seems to be using, even when it's not explicitly derived from complexity, and that is the network. Everyone talks about networks. And the network is a useful concept in a sense that it does embody this type of system which is open, which is far from equilibrium, and which doesn't reduce the entities to just outcomes or products of a greater structure. We've seen, of course, this idea of the network developing greatly through the work of Manuel Castells. He's done a lot to popularize that concept, and in fact, his description of a network is very much in tune with complexity, even if he doesn't explicitly derive it from it. And since it's been applied to a whole range of areas, the changing organization of states, of enterprises, of modes of economic production and consumption, civil society and social movements. Notably, we've seen accounts of the anti-globalization movement, people like Chesters and Welsh that have been mentioned before. But we should also be, I think, very wary of treating networks as only emancipatory or progressive forces, because, of course, when we look at some of the most productive applications of networks in social theory is by looking at criminal gangs, organized crime, mafia, and so on, or terrorist organizations who seem to be very effective complex adaptive systems. And so there's nothing necessarily inherently emancipatory about networks. I think that has to be said. Mark Sageman has done notably very interesting work in suggesting that in the case of quote-unquote, the war on terror, we have a leaderless jihad, which is essentially the natural outcome of a bottom-up mechanism of group formation in a specific environment shaped by top-down counter-terrorist strategy. So there's a continuous interplay between top-down phenomena and bottom-up, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. We're running out of time, so I'll just conclude with a general, you know, the general statement, I think, that underpins our approach. We are arguing that we should take the ontology of complexity seriously, and we would follow Edgar Morin in his distinction between restricted and generalized complexity, between attempts to harness complexity to established modes of scientific inquiry and to the full embrace of its profound implications for the acquisition of knowledge of the world and actions within it. So as Morin puts it, restricted complexity made possible important advances in formalization in the possibilities of modeling, which themselves favor interdisciplinary potentialities. But one still remains within the epistemology of classical science. When one searches for the laws of complexity, one still attaches complexity as a kind of wagon behind a truth locomotive, that which produces laws. So we would suggest that if we are to embrace general complexity, we have to abandon attempts to discover covering laws, or at least to find them severely restricted. We should turn to analysis of process and transactions, of mechanisms, but through complexity, it offers a new systems theory, but a systems theory that remains open and doesn't suffer from the critiques of totalization or closure which were made of previous structuralist or systems theories. I think we'll stop now.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, should we go questions, please?
It's very easy to make any account misses out factor X.
Sorry, can you speak up a bit?
Sorry. It's very easy to criticise any conception that it misses out factor X, for example, the emergence of social actors, whatever other thing it involves. But any understanding will involve some relevance decisions about what is relevant in the particular case you're understanding, whether, for example, social actors are emerging in the particular social phenomenon you're observing. But that doesn't, just saying you're missing out something isn't very helpful. Surely you've got to move to when you can miss out certain factors and when you can't. Am I understood? Are you saying anything more than you're just missing out some dynamic and difficult factors? Or are you taking a holist view that there are some things where you just can't understand anything and that you've actually got to make the relevance decision, you've got to include everything?
Well, I think firstly we should be quite, I think, careful when we try and operationalize complexity. I think science has been regularly recruited to provide the types of certainties that policymakers, and we've fed policymakers with certainty where there wasn't certainty.
Mm.
I think we should be very careful that that's not what complexity becomes.
Yeah.
We can make, you know, we can offer very nice visualizations, but that makes it very open, for example, to manipulation and exploitation and recuperation for a number of objectives. I think that one of the arguments I would make is that I'm slightly uncomfortable when we talk about entities as if they're fixed entities. For example, talk about resilience and return to normalcy seem to me slightly problematic, because I'm not sure we can ever really talk about, in many cases, about a continuity in the types of systems that we're talking about.
I agree, but isn't that true of all reification and talking about any labels or any ontology? That you give a label to something for the purposes of discussing it, and for that label to have any meaning, there's got to be some reliability in the attribution of that label over the time scale you're looking at, just so you can discuss it, but that's always true, isn't it?
Well, perhaps it's always true, but I think it's heavily problematized by complexity. When we talk about, when we think about, let's design systems so they are resilient. If we think, for example, of the Britain before the Second World War, and Britain after after the Second World War. If we just think about war as a crisis that has disrupted society and we return to some state of normalcy, then we miss all the social transformation process that have occurred. Women have entered the workforce. The society at the end of the Second World War is certainly not the same. So, I think my fear is that we lapse into quite old-fashioned conceptions about normalization and regulation of systems, and we miss some of the transformational dynamics. But maybe Simon.
No, it's
okay. Please.
I enjoyed reading your paper, and it raises some, it provokes a lot of thought for me, but one of the thoughts is this. By seeking to complexify the language, as you put it, is it possible that rather than saving complex systems of modelling, you are returning to metaphor?
Well,
richness and complexity.
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, your question implies that metaphor is somehow a weak or poor way of implying complexity.
I don't imply that at all.
No,
I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
I think our kind of argument here is that modelling is one particular methodology that can flow from this kind of processual or complex ontology, but it's only one methodology, i.e. methodologies are independent of the particular social ontology, and it can be developed in a number of different ways. And therefore, modelling has a particular disciplinary history, but there are other methodologies that have different disciplinary histories that are equally valid. So modelling is just one approach, we feel.
Well, let me rephrase it and say, not about returning to metaphor, but reinventing metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
If your paper reads as if you're exerting some kind of passport control over metaphor, say, can it be admitted to the house of complex adaptive system modelling? So I'm just wondering whether, really, your own convictions lie more moving out of the field, beyond the complex adaptive system modelling, into a new mandate for the use of metaphor to illuminate cases rather than test models.
Well, perhaps, but I think there's a room for modelling. It's just that I think our dissatisfaction to some extent is, I think there's a problem where I see models that seek to model reality, that we're getting the idea that this is actually a representation of real systems. And Armando will probably speak about that better than me. But my feeling is that what we should be using models for is to develop intuition about certain dynamics. And we should think very carefully about what we're doing when we're modelling. I can see how we can slide very quickly to producing models which are satisfying policymakers and providing them with certainties. And I'm pretty convinced we'll get into the same trouble we've had in the past when we tried modelling. All this nonlinear mathematics is not gonna yield better results in the end. But I do think there's some value in modelling in understanding certain dynamics, in giving insights. I think if we're going to talk to policymakers, we do want them to I know it's challenging, but we do want them to understand some of the processes and the dynamics, not just give them the end result, because people will latch onto that, and it will just feed into the politics of policymaking, and it won't really give profound insight.
Please. Sorry, yeah.
I think one of the difficulties with the whole issue about modelling and not modelling that plays itself out in this community a lot is that with no modelling, there would be no complexity theory. That is where it's come from. So that it does develop an ontology. So there are generalised statements of the nature of the way the world is that come out of that modelling about the world is systemic, the world, things are emergent, it's historically defined, patterns are there in things that don't sustain forever. So that it gives us an ontological understanding of the world, but it's derived from modelling. And I think that creates a kind of constant tension, really, within the community.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it feels like the people that do modelling for people know that this is a kind of conversation that you're having. And a representation and shed some light on reality. It's the policymakers who constantly want certainty. It's not the modellers in some ways. The other point I just wanted to make, which I think is really interesting, is about this use of... I'm not used to using the word adaptive in the middle of complex systems. I would say it's irrefutable, I would say, that social systems are complex. Whether or not they adapt is another matter. And I don't know why this word has kind of got shoehorned in. It sounds like we believe that all complex systems adapt, and they may or may not, I suppose. I don't know what you think about that.
The historic reasons, that's where it comes from. complex adaptive systems, neural networks, genetic algorithms. Yeah.
But Prigogine, and you know, if you go back further, there was no adaptive. It's
yeah.
A, it's
yeah,
a later.
I prefer to use complex social systems.